Today is day 516, which are 73 weeks and 5 days of the captivity of now 59 hostages, living and dead, in Gaza.
This is TLV1.
This episode may contain explicit language.
To the Promise Podcast, brought to you on TLV1, the voice of the city that is the proud home of colossal and gorgeous new residential towers that, according to the financial newspaper Globes, which is universally acknowledged to be authoritative in such matters, are, quote-unquote, more expensive than the Champs-Élysées. The Champs-Élysées being, of course, the Grand Avenue in Paris's 8th arrondissement, running between the Place de la Concorde and the Place de Charles de Gaulle, upon which Grand Avenue you will find the Arc de Triomphe. Already in 1856, the great 19th century architect Achille Herman called the Champs-Élysées the quote-unquote most beautiful avenue in the whole world, and it was the novelist, sometimes diplomat, and one-time assistant to Herbert Marcuse, Pierre-Jean Remy, who said in 1993 that, quote, there is only one place in the world where it is impossible not to be moved, the Champs-Élysées. Well, if cost per meter is a good metric for beauty and inherent worth, and I think you will agree that it is, then, as Globes reports in the article this week, rather on the nosedly titled Tel Aviv Prices More Expensive Than Champs-Élysées, you will be moved to the tune of 85,000 new Israeli shekels per square meter at the new Hamesila Park Tower project. That's just under $24,000, while the average price per meter of real estate on the Champs-Élysées is just 15,111 euros or 58,000 new Israeli shekels or 16,000 USD, which is to say that the apartment that you will buy at Hamesila Park will be 1.5 times as valuable as what you will get on the Champs-Élysées. And hence, if, as Pierre-Jean Remy said, the Champs-Élysées is the one place where it is impossible not to be moved, the Hamesila Tower is the 1.5 place where it is impossible not to be moved 50% more. Of course, the comparison of Park Hamesila, the new and delightful 1.33 kilometer ribbon of park planted on what was once the site of the tracks of the old Ottoman era train that ran from Allenby Street to the main station outside of Jaffa, and the line that then ran from there to Jerusalem, the comparison of Park Hamesila to the Champs-Élysées pricks the imagination and puts one in mind of the many other similarities between these two grand treasures of urban planning and architecture, like the fact that when the Nazis conquered Paris on June 14, 1940, after France famously adopted its quote-unquote open city strategy of offering no resistance to the Germans, so as to save the city from the damage and death that results from house-to-house fighting, the first act of the vanquishing army was to hold a huge military parade down the Champs-Élysées, a symbolic act that was echoed when, 4 years later, General Charles de Gaulle led his own parade on the Champs-Élysées upon the liberation of Paris. In a perhaps similar way, Park Hamesila wends its way just meters from the old Lawrence Café, owned and operated by Templar Germans, which Lawrence Café for years served as the informal headquarters of the Land of Israel Nazi Party, after opening in the first years of the 20th century, its proprietors being the Templar industrialist and businessman Franz Lawrence. And the place quickly became the meeting spot for Tony Germans in Palestine and earned a name for itself as early as 1909 as the place in the area where one went to see motion pictures, then a new technology, which were screened regularly. In his book, Tmol Shilshom, only yesterday, Shai Agdon writes of the cafe with some respect, though he adds at the end, these Germans, who are expert at everything, do not know how to make tea, end quote. Over the 1920s and 1930s, and even after the war began, the Lawrence Café became a spot where the Palestine Nazi Party had its meetings and drank its drinks, including beer imported from Munich, though the Palestine Post described in its February 17th, 1936 edition how a group of 40 members of the nationalist Beitar movement attacked the café, shattering the windows and breaking the tables. By this time, the Templars had adopted an Aryan Uber Alles program of refusing to rent apartments in Tel Aviv to Jews, Jews, and also of greeting one another in the streets with Nazi salutes. A Nazi flag flew over the nearby German consulate building. In 1935, there were 250 members of the Nazi Party of Palestine. In 1938, there were 330, or just under 1 in 5 of all the Templar Germans in the country then. In 1941, the British rounded up the Germans, some of whom were expelled to Austria and others of whom were interned in detention camps spread throughout Palestine. Surprisingly, or if you think about it, maybe not so surprisingly at all, none of the experts evaluating the strange similarity between the Champs-Élysées and Parc Hamasila have spoken or written on record about the shared Nazi history of the two places, though surely it goes a great way towards explaining the phenomenon. Still, arguably nothing captures the spirit of this city we love so well, Tel Aviv-Yafo, better than the satisfaction of knowing that 80 years on, our Nazi-inflected real estate has 1.5 times the worth of their Nazi-inflected real estate, instantiating what the great Jewish philosopher Emil Fackenheim probably called the 12th commandment after his 11th commandment, thou shalt not give Hitler a posthumous victory, the 12th being thou shalt take mortgages of prodigious proportions, which is perhaps the greatest karmic historical victory of all time. With us today is a woman about whom the novelist, sometimes diplomat, and one-time assistant to Herbert Marcuse, Pierre-Jean Rémé, would surely have said, had he had the good fortune to know her instead of Herbert Marcuse, there is only one person in the world about whom it is impossible not to be moved. Also, where Herbert Marcuse famously saw people in postmodern times as one-dimensional men, this woman sees everyone in 3 dimensions, sometimes more, and in beautiful, rich colors. I think you know that woman can only be Miriam Herzlag. Miriam Herzlag is the Ops and Blogs editor of the Times of Israel, creating and residing over the biggest and most profound forum of Jewish discourse and debate since the Talmud was codified. Miriam was in the past the anchor of the Israel Broadcast Authority English language television news, and she was an editor and anchor for the Israel Broadcast Authority English language radio news. Miriam, how are you?
I'm okay. I'm happy to be here with you right now.
I am happy that you are here. Also with us today is a woman who can only properly be described as très magnifique and whose somewhat recent co-adjunctification with the Promise Podcast family is nothing less than a triumph. Obviously, that woman could only be Sarah Yael Hirshhorn. Sarah Yael Hirshhorn is senior researcher at the Comper Center for the Interdisciplinary Study of Antisemitism and Racism, another important Nazi connection. And she is an instructor at the Ruderman Program for American Jewish Studies at the University of Haifa. She is also a fellow at the Jewish People Policy Institute in Jerusalem, about which I think everyone would agree that if any People Policy Institute had been present when the Torah was given at Sinai, it would have been the Jewish People Policy Institute. Sarah has professed at the fanciest universities on 3 continents, in the old country, in the new world, and in our historic homeland. Her book, City on a Hilltop, American Jews and the Israeli Settler Movement, won prestigious prizes and is in itself a triumph. Sarah is also all over the news in print, on radio and podcasts, and on the television. It is she who keeps me from deleting my Twitter account on account of her using the medium with the skill that Yasha Heifetz used the fiddle. Sarah, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm thinking about what Eli Sharabi said in his Uvda interview about opening the refrigerator and being able to take out whatever you want as I sip my coffee speaking with you today.
It does make you feel those things about the little things in life. I mean, it almost feels cliche, but you listen to something like that and you think, oh my God, there is so much richness even in the lives, the parts of my life that I grumble about. Sarah is shaking her head for those of you who happen not to be looking into the video screen as I am. As for me, my name is Noah Ephron. I don't mean to boast, but there was reason for me to take an unexpected trip abroad all at once, arrangements arranged in a tizzy, which is how it happened that I found myself on the phone with United on Sunday trying to push up my departure to the next day. And the woman on the other end says, there will be a significant change fee. And I said, because I travel pretty often, I said, I thought because I have a super duper rare precious metal status, it may even be one of those same rare precious metals that Donald Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky are negotiating about. I thought maybe I was allowed to make changes for free. I thought I read that somewhere. And the woman, she stopped for a beat and she collected herself and she said, sir, I want to start by acknowledging your status, which I appreciate and which all of United Airlines appreciates. And I want also to acknowledge that few of our clients ever reach the status that you have, just so that is clear. And then there was another beat, and then the woman went on and she said, in this case in particular, though, your status makes no difference as far as the change fees goes. Though, again, it does make a difference to me and to us at United. And please don't take this to be a brag. God, I hope that I learned better from my parents than that. But I have often wondered if I would know when I had reached my own personal moment of peak jerkiness, my own personal record in imperiousness and easy, unaware arrogance and pretension. It is a very high bar. And I am really not boasting when I say that that woman on the phone pausing in our conversation to acknowledge my high metallic status. At that moment, I knew, baby, I just knew. Today, we got two topics of profound importance. But first, we have this matter that we are following with alert interest and great concern as part of an occasional series that we like to call The Promised Podcast, ponders the persisting, prevailing power and pathos of past professions and their purveyors. Exactly 100 years ago, Shlomo Bertunov was born in Moscow. His father, Yehoshua Bertunov, was then one of the inner circle of the Habima Theater, which he had been part of since the very beginning when it was founded in Bialystok in 1913 by a 26-year-old actor-director named Nahum David Tzemach. Story goes, Yehoshua Bertunov, who was 8 years older than Nahum Tzemach, with 8 years of acting on the Yiddish and Russian stage in Vilna behind him, playing, for instance, in Russian stagings of Othello, Lear, and Hamlet, Yehoshua Bertunov offered to barter acting lessons for Nahum Tzemach in exchange for Nahum Tzemach teaching him Hebrew. When the company was invited that year to put on a play at the 11th Zionist Congress in Vienna, it was Yehoshua Bertunov who directed it, a Hebrew translation of Osip Daimov's Russian drama about the trials of Jewish immigration called The Eternal Wanderer. After that, Yehoshua Bertunov got the job of directing the Russian State Theater in Tbilisi, Georgia, and running an amateur Yiddish theater on the side. And it was there in Tbilisi in 1915 that a first child was born to Yehoshua and Miriam Bertunov. Miriam was also an actress of some renown, and they named the child Dvorah. 10 years later, while Yehoshua Bertunov was back with Habima, now in Moscow, putting on the company's historic Hebrew language production of Shin Onsky's Yiddish masterpiece, The Dybbuk, which the future first prime minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, saw on a work visit to Moscow, in which he called, quote, one of the most unforgettable experiences. I am stunned, shaken, unable to find comfort, end quote. While Yehoshua Bertunov and Habima were doing that, Shlomo Bertunov was born. He was only three when, in 1928, the Bertunovs pulled up stakes in Moscow and moved to Tel Aviv. Shlomo, as I said, was three, Dvorah was 13, and Yehoshua and Miriam were in their 30s. Dvorah Bertunov, Shlomo's big sister, would soon head back to Europe. In Palestine at the age of 14, she had a solo dance show, and by the next year, she was accepted in Berlin to study modern and classical dance. When she was 16, she did a command performance in the living room of Albert Einstein. And soon after that, she was touring England and the United States, where she took a role in the Lexington Avenue, New York production of The Dybbuk, in the famous Dance of the Beggars and Paupers scene. While all this was happening for his big sister, Shlomo Bertunov was a kid in school in Tel Aviv, eventually going to Gymnasia Herzliya, the high school where today my Chavura meets, and then after that, starting his studies at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. The Bertunov family was on my mind last week because I biked back for a book to Beit Levik in a building at number 30 Dov Hoz Street, which building 55 years ago in 1970 was given over to the Jung Yiddish group to serve as the center of Yiddish culture in Israel. I mentioned the place when I talked about the great Yiddish writer Yisrael Rudnitsky, who died in Tel Aviv at 100 a month and a bit ago. And I've been to Beit Levik before, but this time was the first time that I noticed that on a column in the front of the building, there is a sign, above a sign that reads, private parking, Beit Levik, foreign vehicles will be towed. There is a big plaque that reads, quote, in this house lived the actor and director of the Habima National Theater, Yehoshua Bertunov, 5639 to 5731, 1879 to 1971, and his daughter, the dancer and choreographer, Dvorah Bertunov, 5675 to 5770, or 1915 to 2010, and his son, the Bible reciter, Karyan HaTanach, and teacher, Shlomo Bertonov, 5685 to 5737, 1925 to 1977. And having finally noticed the plaque for the first time, two things struck me. The one, that we are at the centenary of Shlomo Bertonov's birth, and I tapped my phone and learned that he was indeed born in February. The centenary had only just passed. And the second thing that struck me was, what is a Bible reciter, a Karyan HaTanach, which surely is a profession like elevator operator or match girl or soda jerk that once existed but no longer does. In fact, it was hard for me to imagine just what a Bible reciter would do. Recite from the Bible, of course, but for whom, how, and why? When I looked into the archive, I found that Bible reciter was a profession that existed for only one generation, from the late 1940s to the late 1970s. And while there were several Bible reciters who were each famous in their day, probably none was as famous and as beloved as Shlomo Bertonov. It was when Shlomo Bertonov was a student at the Hebrew University, not yet 20 years old, living in the not yet capital of a not yet established Jewish state, that he received an offer to broadcast nightly, live at first, from the studios of the Voice of Jerusalem radio station, what would become, after David Ben-Gurion declared the state on May 14, 1948, the Voice of Israel radio station, a segment called Pirkei Hayom Batanach, the Daily Bible Portions. It surely helped that Shlomo Bertonov was a Bertonov, son of the great Habima actor and director Yehoshua Bertonov. And it surely helped that Shlomo Bertonov had come to the country when he was just 3 years old, and that his Hebrew was not an immigrant's Hebrew, but the Hebrew of a man whose schooling, whose boyhood castabouts, whose first kiss, these were all in Hebrew. Just why the people behind the Voice of Jerusalem, mostly party sorts, politicians and ideologues who believed with Lenin that radio would be the broadsheet of tomorrow, and who believed with Hitler that in radio was the capacity to meld people into a people, just why they decided that a daily recitation of portions from the Tanakh, from the Bible, was needed, has a great deal to do with what they thought radio was for and could do, and had a great deal to do with what Zionists believed that Tanakh or Bible was for and could do. And it had a great deal, too, to do with what they thought a voice, just a voice, so long as it was the right voice, could do, speaking Hebrew. The great Harvard historian of Zionism, Derek Penslar, has an essay called Transmitting Jewish Culture, Radio in Israel, and he sets this all out. From early on, most every Zionist leader in the Yishuv in Jewish Palestine believed in radio. It was in 1926 that David Ben-Gurion and Burl Katzenelson established the Radio and Electrotechnical Institute with money from the trade union, the Chevrat Ovdim. The Brits worried about putting radio into the hands of the natives. What would they say? What would they do? But by 1932, ahead of the Levant trade fair in Tel Aviv, they let a Zionist station broadcast for the first time. Though wanting to keep control over the messages, they soon set up their own Palestine Broadcast System, or PBS, which had English, Hebrew, and Arabic shows, the Hebrew service taking its own name, the Voice of Jerusalem, and taking control of the 6 hours a day of Hebrew programming that His Majesty's High Commissioner of Palestine granted them the right to program. It was the Voice of Jerusalem that decided that the official sanctioned version of Hebrew pronunciation over the airwaves had to be the Sfaradi pronunciation, following a ruling 3 decades earlier in 1913 by the Hebrew Language Committee. Radio handbooks from the 1940s set out black on white that an ayin has to be an ayin, that a chet has to be a chet, that a resh has to be a resh. Some of this had to do with an almost mystical belief among the very unmystical, mostly men of the radio, that spoken Hebrew, that Hebrew speech itself has a sort of redemptive power. In the minds of people like David Ben-Gurion, and there were many others besides him, one of the sorrows and degradations of diaspora Judaism was that it was all about books, about words on a page, which are, they thought, abstract and distant. It was the spoken word that could raise Jewish culture, raise Jews from their torpor, from their political dormancy. In the Bible, God thundered at Jews, Eyeh Asher Eyeh, I am what I am. It was the sound that came first. Aristotle had said that spoken words are symbols of thoughts, while written words are just symbols of spoken words. They're twice removed. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau had said that writing sucks the life out of speech. And now, exactly at the time when Jews were rising from generations of sluggish languor, at least the way David Ben-Gurion and his sort saw things, radio had risen, putting the life back into words as long as they were the right words, said the right way. And for David Ben-Gurion, and again, there were many others beside him, the right words, the Zionist words, they were from the Bible. The Bible was the fountainhead. It was a muscular book describing muscular Jews in a muscular way. The great Tel Aviv historian of Zionism, Anita Shapira, has an essay called David Ben-Gurion and the Bible. And in it, she describes how deeply David Ben-Gurion believed that the motive, the force, the justification behind Zionism, you could find it all in the Bible, all in the Tanakh. It was Ben-Gurion who defiantly told the 1936 Peel Commission, which came up with the plan to partition Palestine, creating a Palestinian state and a Jewish state, quote, this is David Ben-Gurion, the mandate, meaning the British mandate to control Palestine, is not our Bible. Rather, the Bible is our mandate, end quote. In an essay he wrote years later after the state was a fact, David Ben-Gurion wrote that the stories in the Tanakh, quote, have greater relevance, are closer. They infuse the generation that was born and raised and is living in this land with an essential vigor, far more so than all the speeches and disputes in the congresses at Basel. The human and social values we espouse, including Jewish redemption and universal human salvation, these were all articulated most forcefully by the prophets, end quote. This was what was needed to be on the radio, the medium that would teach wave after wave of immigrants what it means to be an Israeli and what it means in a world with a sovereign Israel to be a Jew. There were discussions into the night when Shlomo Bertinov started reading his nightly readings of the Tanakh about maybe adding commentaries to the recitations, but the Ben-Gurionist purists said, no, it is the words of the Bible themselves that do the work we need to get done. What the savants of the diaspora added, for our purposes, it just detracts. Though, it must be said, Shlomo Bertinov, he later remembered that, quote, I approached the position with great care and great concern. I would spend hours every night in the National Library poring over the different commentaries in order to read the chapters on the radio just right. They gave the program 5 minutes every night, end quote. For 30 years, until just before he died, very young at 52 of cancer in 1977, Shlomo Bertinov recited the Tanakh most every night on the radio, in a voice that the poet Nathan Alterman said admiringly was, quote unquote, the voice of God himself. This is not all he did. He was also an actor, and he taught acting, and he taught elocution, Hebrew reading. And I found in the archives posters advertising evenings like this one in Ramat Gan on Rosh Chodesh Tevet, the first day of Tevet, in 1956, that reads, Yoshua Devorah Shlomo Bertinov in an evening of acting, dance, and Bible recitation, accompanied by the piano of Mrs. Yocheved Shiloh, end quote. And on nights like these, and there were many, father, daughter, and son each did what they do, and one is left to imagine the audience is listening to, say, a soliloquy from Hamlet, followed by a modern dance, followed by a solemn reading from the Book of Books. Here, so you will know what such a reading is like, is Shlomo Bertinov reading from Melachim Bet, from Kings 2, chapter 15, in a recording that appeared on a long-playing phonograph record that, one imagines, might be played over and over again, maybe by a parent for their child.
Ben 20 shana Ahaz b'molcho, ve-16 shana malach b'Yerushalayim, ve-lo asa ha-yashar b'enei Adonai k'David Aviv. וילך בדרכי מלכי ישראל, וגם מסכות עשה לבעלים. והוא הכתיר בגבן הנום, ויבער את בניו באש כתועבות הגויים אשר הוריש אדוני מפני בני ישראל, ויזבח ויקטר בבמות ועל הגבעות, ותחת כל עץ רענן.
And the voice of Shlomo Bertinov, for generations of Israelis, became the voice we hear in our heads when we read the Tanakh to ourselves. Every Yom Kippur in our Chavura, we have a reading of the temple service, and it is a moving moment, a moment of real awe. And the power of the thing comes from the words themselves, of course, the living fear with which the high priest faces divine immolation if the people he represents to God are this year found to be irredeemable. But most of the power of the thing comes from the fact that Eli, our talented comrade and friend, he reads as he learned to read, as so many of us learned to read, from Shlomo Bertinov on the radio. Each week at the Havdalah service at Hostage Square, a woman from near Oz in her 80s, I should know her name, but I do not, she stands up and speaks about her loved ones who are still hostage, and lately, her loved ones who are no longer hostages. And each week, she speaks about the Torah portion we just read that morning, sometimes reciting in a slow, clear voice that owes something to Shlomo Bertinov, those verses that maybe tell us something about how to understand the seemingly biblical times we are living through now. I am an old yeshiva bacher, a remarkably ignorant one, but still in perspective, a yeshiva bacher. We, the boys among us, stopped learning Tanakh in the fifth grade. Bible was for girls, we understood. Talmud was what mattered to us. And I've always regarded with some disparagement the old Zionist enthusiasm for Tanakh alone, David Ben-Gurion's version of Martin Luther's doctrine of sola scriptura. But seeing now, all these years later, how these chapters and verses can explain ourselves to ourselves, I see that 30 years of nightly broadcasts had to them a gift. They were a resource that we are now pressing into service, and I appreciate it. And I appreciate, too, the fact that the Bertinov's Tel Aviv home at 30 Dov Ho Street is now home to the Center for Yiddish Culture in Israel, which is surely, to Shlomo Bertinov's thesis, some sort of antithesis, blessedly, and with no synthesis in sight. Today, two topics. Topic one, out of phase, is phase one of the hostage and prisoner release / ceasefire agreement entered into 46 days ago through intermediaries with Hamas, ended last Shabbat. According to that phase one agreement on day 16, that is to say 30 days ago as I speak, we were supposed to begin dotting I's and crossing T's on the terms and conditions of phase two, but those negotiations never started, seemingly because Prime Minister Netanyahu refused to send his negotiating team to start them, preferring instead to work out the details of what comes next with U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, who, one imagines, is less demanding and generally more pleasant than the representatives of Hamas, and now we are phaseless, just phaseless people in a crowd, and we will wonder, well, what now? And topic two, commission perdition, as the Likud, through its sacrificial MK, Ari Kellner, presents its plan for a commission of inquiry into the events leading to, upon, and after October 7th, that will not be impaneled and run by Supreme Court justices, according to the Likud plan, the way most such commissions about matters of such weight have been run over the past 56 years. And we will talk about the proposal and what it does and does not do, as well as whether or not it stands a chance of being adopted and whether or not it should stand such a chance. And for our most unreasonably generous Patreon supporters, sadly, today, owing to the topsy-turvy nature of fate and last-minute international travels, we got bupkis. We will not this week have an extra special extra discussion, but we do promise to think about you with that much extra gratitude and extra fondness for keeping this leaky ship of a podcast afloat at sea for yet another week. So please just know you are the cheese on our pizza. You are the fizz in our champagne. You are the salt on our pretzels, and we love you and thank you. But before people start to say, yo, you and your Patreon people need to get a room, please listen to this.
Like a woman, so it's a היית מלעקק אותם, לחבק אותם, לשחק איתם, מדבר למחזה. היא הבינה שאין לה ברירה בלבד, חוכמת הפרטים הקטנים. אל תקרא לי מותר, כי זה מביא לי בריחה, זה עושה אותי לדקי שמולד. אל תקרא לי מותר, כי זה מביא לי בריחה, זה עושה אותי לדקי שמולד. מותר גדלה, מרומדת בפוך סוחה, צלחת שמנת, שמנת. יש לה שלושים, עשר חוקים חיוך בגוף כמו נכונה ושמנת. היית מלעקק אותה, מחבק אותה, מסמק איתה, מטפל לה בחזה. היא הזירה.
That song is Al Tikra Li Motek by Corinne Alal, of course, and Eran Tzur, which just came out now a couple of months after Corinne Alal of Blessed Memory died. It came out along with Eran Tzur's very sad, remarkable new record, Simanim Makdimim, which we will listen to over the course of the show. And now it is time for our first discussion. So Miriam, it is really hard to be phaseless, ain't it?
This is a fast-changing story. We're recording on Thursday, and last night Donald Trump issued a new ultimatum to Hamas, posting on Truth Social, where all important policy announcements are made now. Trump wrote, "Release all of the hostages now, not later, and immediately return all of the dead bodies of the people you murdered, or it is over for you," over in all caps. We don't know yet, or may never know, the operational meaning of this threat, but we do know what has played out in recent weeks and what press reports tell us about the latest formulations for next steps. Phase one of the hostage and prisoner release and ceasefire agreement that Israel entered into with Hamas on January 15th ended this past Saturday. It was 42 days during which Hamas released 33 hostages, 25 living and 8 dead, and Israel released 1,904 security prisoners. These included more than 700 who were serving life terms for attempted murder and, most often, for murder. During that time, Israeli soldiers withdrew from most of Gaza, and Israel allowed 600 truckloads of food, medicine, clothing, and other essential supplies to enter Gaza each day. During phase one, Israel was to have withdrawn from the Philadelphia corridor, leaving its control in Egyptian hands, but it did not. According to the agreement signed by the sides through intermediaries, negotiations were supposed to begin on January 31st, 16 days into phase one, over the terms and conditions of a second phase. During the second phase, Hamas was to release all of the living hostages still in its hands. The number is thought to be 24. And Israel was to release another 2,000 or so security prisoners. According to the January document, after phase two, there was to be a third phase in which Hamas would return the bodies of the remaining hostages, and Israel and Hamas would declare a binding armistice, ending the war. But the negotiations over the details of phase two of the agreement never really started. In his visit to the White House at around this time, Prime Minister Netanyahu and members of his entourage met several times with the U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff. They described these meetings as a sort of alternative start of phase two negotiations. This week, the Office of Prime Minister Netanyahu announced that rather than proceed to phase two of the original agreement, he had embraced what he described as the Witkoff plan. Full details of the plan have not been made public, but it seems to call for an extension of the phase one agreement, with Hamas handing over half of the live hostages, that's 12, as well as some number of the 35 remaining bodies, and Israel releasing Palestinian security prisoners. Basically, this amounts to a six-week extension of phase one of the agreement. The Prime Minister's office said in a statement a few days ago that, with the end of phase one of the hostage deal, and in light of Hamas's refusal to accept the Witkoff outline for continuing talks, to which Israel agreed, Prime Minister Netanyahu has decided that as of this morning, all entry of goods and supplies into the Gaza Strip will cease. Israel will not allow a ceasefire without the release of our hostages. If Hamas continues its refusal, there will be further consequences. Those further consequences were expected to include an order sending Palestinians who, over the last month and a half, returned to what is left of their homes in the north of the Gaza Strip, back to so-called safe zones in the south, and resuming the bombing and active ground attack of the areas in the north from which the IDF recently withdrew. Such a development would fulfill the dreams and wishes of Netanyahu's religious Zionist coalition partners, who threatened to leave the government if Israel enters an armistice with Hamas, and it would be a nightmare and most dreaded development for the families of the hostages remaining in Gaza and the great number of Israelis for whom returning all the hostages to Israel as quickly as possible is their most pressing priority. Sarah, what should we make of this odd moment when phase one has ended, phase two has not begun, and just what will happen and even just what should happen is hard to see with clarity?
I think it's a very difficult time for the families of the hostages. Clearly, there's no clear path forward for the return, either of the living hostages or the dead. And this moment of uncertainty is a moment that can't be wasted. We've seen the condition of the hostages that have returned in recent weeks, and it seems quite obvious that every moment and second in a Hamas tunnel is one that risks the deaths of those that are alive and the further deterioration of those that are no longer with us. So it's very sad. Although I do think that there's some reason to think that maybe this three-phase deal should have been shaken up and can be shaken up. That was something that both Netanyahu and Trump received essentially from the Biden administration. This was something that President Biden announced probably about a year ago now, that this would be the way that the hostage release and the prisoner exchange would develop. But I'm not sure that we are wedded to this path. It's only a question of what follows it. What I've found very striking over the last several weeks, however, is hearing the interviews with returned hostages who say over and over and over again, and I've learned this new word in Hebrew, that, the word for closure is the rather poetic lisgoret ha-ma'agal. It's basically to close the circle. And they say themselves that even those who have returned are still there in a tunnel because they're thinking of those they left behind. And we owe it both to those who are here with us now, again, joyously, and hopefully in good health and good spirits, to return their colleagues as much for everyone, because it seems that the whole country really can't move on until they are back, either alive, we hope, or unfortunately dead.
What do you think accounts for Netanyahu's reticence to continue forward? Save for the fact that he faces coalition partners who, especially the religious Zionists, who will leave the coalition if he does go forward, though his government is not in danger of falling itself. So what do you, aside from that, or maybe that's the only reason, but aside from that, if that's not the only reason, why do you think he does not wish to go forward?
I think there is a strategy here, a callous strategy, and one that most Israelis refuse to adopt. But Netanyahu has not achieved the core goal of his war, which was to crush Hamas. And without doing so, I don't think he will give up this project. He certainly will not give up the Philadelphia corridor, which he has stated is, the key to his strategy. But further, decapitating the leadership of Hamas hasn't happened. We've seen them parading the hostages week after week in elaborate ceremonies in seemingly full control of the Gaza Strip, not only the parts where the civilians have fled, have run away from, but also places that the IDF was said to be in control. So I think Netanyahu feels that the remaining hostages, which are for the most part no longer humanitarian hostages, may need to be sacrificed on the altar of the total annihilation of Hamas. I don't believe this strategy is one that the Israeli people will accept. They've said over and over again that, you know, they want to have the hostages home, and this is the most meaningful metric of success in the war. But I think Netanyahu is reluctant to go back to what essentially would be a pre-October 6th status quo, where the hostages are home, but Hamas still remains in control of the Gaza Strip. So I think he has much bigger ambitions than returning the hostages, and unfortunately their lives may need to be sacrificed, I think, in his mind.
I think you might be exactly right that that is what's going on with Netanyahu. And the thing that's so confounding about it and disturbing about it for me is, after a year and a half of war, most of which was carried on without any real practical limitations on what Israel could do, he and we did not manage to do this. So then it seems as though it's magical thinking to think, okay, so we'll take another month or another 6 months, and there, and then we will achieve our goal. Miriam, what do you think about all of this?
Well, I think that, you know, it's very likely that by the time we are being listened to, things will have changed, just because there is just such a sort of a massive number of factors that are affecting this. So I want to introduce just a few. One is that there is a budget to be passed. You said that that Netanyahu's government is secure, but it is very likely that he will not have the support of the Haredi members of the government, and be even more reliant on the ultra-right wing. And that happens in a couple of weeks. It has to be done by the end of March. You have a new chief of staff, Eyal Zamir, whose approach is rather than what we call the small, smart army. He wants a large, smart army. He's a ground war guy from the tank corps. And so I think there's a hope that this new appointment, a hope, you know, in the world of Netanyahu, that this new appointment will bring different military strategies that haven't been tried. Hard to imagine, but, you know, that could be factoring in there. And then you have the real wild card, which is President Donald Trump, and who is being, you know, largely sort of activated by the visible, invisible hand of Miriam Adelson, who ensured that, you know, that hostages were flown over to sit through the hour and 40 minutes of Trump's recent address to the Houses of Congress and meet. You know, I'm watching on a loop the handshake. It's on the front page right now of the front page, excuse me, the homepage of the Times of Israel. You can see a GIF there with them, all of these, you know, left-wing, you know, hostages shaking hands with Donald Trump, believing, rightly so, that there isn't a great alternative right now. So I'm just saying it's an extremely, I think part of it is that all of the cards are up in the air. So there is delaying going on right now that I think, and the final I just need to mention is the Arabs. The Arab world met in Cairo. They announced a plan that didn't involve deportation of Gaza and also did not, quite to talk about the elimination of Hamas as a leadership figure in the Strip. And so there's sort of work on multi fronts going on, and the cost of that is being paid by a young man sitting with shrapnel in his eye in a tunnel, chained and starved, and whose parents until recently didn't go public because they hoped to protect protect his identity as a soldier, and who now are desperately out there, and multiply that by 24, and that's where we are. So I think is really happening, and this will all change very quickly.
I think you're both really right in your analysis of Netanyahu. I do agree with you too, Miriam, that delaying is a tactic for Prime Minister Netanyahu that he believes sometimes, or maybe often, produces results. And I would just say, you know, pace what the pressure that was on him before Israel attacked in Lebanon to accept this ceasefire agreement, and he refused to. And then there was all that happened in Lebanon and all that happened in Iran, which I think he felt left the country in a much safer position. And that was not something that he could fully have anticipated. But just keeping the thing going created for him opportunities that were somewhat unforeseen. I mean, there were plans for these things, but he didn't know if they would be able to be carried out. And then
Syria is a good example of that as well.
And Syria as well. So for Netanyahu, and this has always been the case with Netanyahu. I mean, it's already 3 decades where Netanyahu has often believed, because he is so confident, rightly, I think, in his ability to improvise politically. He believes that if he just lets shit churn, including, you know, and now with Donald Trump, things are really turning, then he will be able to take good advantage of whatever new situations arise. But then when you think about the person in the tunnel that you were talking about, Miriam, it becomes a strategy that feels heartless. And I guess I will end
and every
here,
moment I, that, you know, it. Every moment that this is slow marched is also a moment for Hamas to regroup. And they're using that time effectively as well. So I think they need to be cognizant of that.
Just another factor is that we are in the month of Ramadan, and sometimes there are avenues for compromise that can be reached during those periods, or it can be more extreme. But, you know, we do need to remember that eventually the withholding of aid is going to hit Gazans, and that also is something Hamas has to take into consideration.
And speaking about compromise, I just want to say I was shocked, Miriam, to hear what you said just a couple of minutes ago, that you are a GIF Jew. I'm a GIF Jew, but I feel as though we still managed somehow to make it work over that big divide. Now listen to this.
Go both ways.
עכשיו אתה רואה את הפינות האפלות של החיים ניסית לחבר בין נקודה לנקודה כדי להבין הכל נראה אותו דבר הכל נראה רגיל שום דבר שלא היה שום דבר חריג באמצע לילה מה מביא אותך לשם אל המקום שבתורך תהיה גר האפריקאי שחיפש מקום לישון והגנב שמחטט בארון כי את השטח אי אפשר ליישר הנה השלט פה כתוב כאן עובדים והאישה נמצאת מתחת מסווה היא והמוות ברומן של בוגדים הספה האדומה נופלת כמו אבן נשארת שלמה המבול שמציף את הדירה אליה ברחת מפני הזיכרונות עכשיו אתה רואה את הפינות האפלות של החיים ניסית לחבר מנקודה לנקודה כדי להבין טרקטור בא.
That song is Hapinota Afelot by Iran Tzor. And now it is time for our second discussion. So, Sarah, you're an academician. Why is the road to a commission paved with suspicion and seemingly bound for perdition?
So Likud member Ari Kilner set out last week the plan that his party head and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tasked him to write. What Kilner calls a quote-unquote egalitarian state commission of inquiry to investigate the debacle of October 7th and learn why no one saw it coming, the Hamas attack on that day, or if not no one, what apparently no one in the government or the security establishment or the military took seriously saw the attack coming on that day, and why the immediate response to the attack was so poorly coordinated and executed, and how the war that followed was conducted. The word egalitarian is important because it distinguishes the scheme that Ariel Kellner and the Likud are proposing from the plain old quote-unquote state commission of inquiry, or Vadat Chakira Mamlachtit, which is the sort of commission delineated in the 1968 law and convened 20 times in the past 57 years. There have been state commissions of inquiry about fixing soccer games. That was the Etzioni Commission of 1971, about why and how the IDF and intelligence services failed to anticipate the Yom Kippur War, the famous 1973 Agronaut Commission, about the lousy state of the prison system, the Kanak Commission of 1979, about who assassinated Labor Party leader Chaim Alozarov on the Tel Aviv boardwalk in 1933, the 1982 Bechor Commission, about the massacres at Sabra and Shatila, the Cohen Commission, also in 1982, as well as Baruch Goldstein's massacres of Palestinian worshippers in Hebron in 1994, Yigal Amir's assassination of Yitzhak Rabin in 1995, the disappearance of immigrant kids from Yemen during the first years of the state. That six-year commission ended in 2001. And a bunch more, the latest being the 2021 investigation of the collapse of the walkway at Mount Moron that led to the deaths of 45 ultra-Orthodox pilgrims who were there to celebrate Lag BaOmer. That commission finished its work last year. The names affixed to all those plain old state commissions of inquiry, the Etzionis, the Agronauts, the Bechors, and the Kohens, are all names of Supreme Court justices who chaired said commissions. The 1968 Commission of Inquiry Law sets out in Section 4D that the chair of any commission of inquiry must either be a Supreme Court justice or a district court judge, including retired judges of that exalted status. It also stipulates in Section 4A that it is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court who decides who serves on the committee and who will be designated as its chair. According to the Commission of Inquiry Law, a commission must have at least three members, although the Chief Justice may increase its size as well as he sees fit, as long as the commission has an odd number of participants. A state commission of inquiry has the right to call anyone as a witness, and those who refuse summons can be fined. And if that is ignored a second time, they can be imprisoned. Further, a state commission of inquiry has the right to subpoena any public document it wants, although it cannot publicize information gained from documents designated as containing state secrets. The proceedings of a state commission of inquiry must also be public, although a commission can carry out closed-door sessions if matters discussed contain state secrets or if they threaten a witness's right to privacy. State commissions of inquiry have a great deal of freedom in deciding the nature and limits of their findings and recommendations, which can include calls for changes in procedure of government and even for the resignation of politicians and public servants. The results of a state commission of inquiry are not, strictly speaking, binding, but by tradition, they've been taken quite seriously by ruling politicians and implemented in whole, or at least in part. The egalitarian state commission of inquiry that Chaver Knesset Ari Kellner proposed last week to investigate October 7th and what became before it and what came after it differs from the above, mostly in the way it is chosen and who will serve on it. Like a regular state commission of inquiry, it will be convened by a vote of the Knesset. Regular state commissions of inquiry can also be convened by the state comptroller, but that has only happened four times in the country's history. But unlike a regular state commission of inquiry, the members of the quote-unquote egalitarian state commission of inquiry are not picked by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, but rather directly or indirectly by the Knesset itself in the following somewhat convoluted way. First, six professionals are approved by a two-thirds supermajority of at least 80 votes in the Knesset. These professionals must include the following: two jurists with credentials sterling enough to make them eligible in principle to serve on the Supreme Court, two retired senior officials in the IDF, the intelligence community, or the police, and two people with rich executive experience running large public or private concerns. If the Knesset fails to reach the supermajority support for these six members of the committee, then the coalition and the opposition will each select a professional from each category. These six professionals, then, will select the seventh and eighth members of the committee, who are to be representatives of the families of the hostages, or soldiers, or civilians who were killed during the war. After that, the now eight members of the committee will collectively choose the ninth member, who will serve as the chairperson of the committee. According to Ari Kellner's proposal, the egalitarian state commission of inquiry will have all the powers and privileges of a regular state commission of inquiry to subpoena witnesses and documents, all deliberations will be broadcast live. The primary motivation behind Ari Kellner's proposal is to wrest control of the investigation of October 7th from the hands of the judges, especially Supreme Court judges. Kellner says that there are two main reasons why this is needed. First, because the courts themselves, and especially the Supreme Court, need to be investigated by the Commission of Inquiry to dope out their role in preventing the politicians and defense establishment from keeping a lid on Hamas for years prior to October 7th. And then, because, as polls show, half the country has lost faith in the objectivity of judges, meaning that whatever a judicially impaneled Commission of Inquiry finds will be greeted by skepticism by at least half of the country. Knesset member Ari Kellner's proposal, which is the Likud's proposal and unveiled with the blessing of the prime minister, was met with little support by the people who have until now insisted that only an old-fashioned judicial state commission of inquiry will do to investigate October 7th. The October Council, a group that represents 1,300 families of victims and survivors of October 7th, issued a very strong-worded statement about the Likud proposal that said in part, "This proposal is not worth the paper it was printed on. The families of the October Council were surprised to hear that Haver Knesset Kellner is advancing, in the name of the prime minister, a whitewashed committee that will be nominated by the people being themselves investigated. We call on the public not to fall for this spin at the expense of our loved ones. This proposal is like another murder of our loved ones. We will not allow for it to go forward." That's a pretty harsh condemnation, Miriam. What should we think of Ariel Kellner's proposal? And more generally, what should we think of any proposal for a commission of inquiry like Kellner's that does not leave the job of assembling and running the committee to Supreme Court justices?
I'm with the families. It's infuriating, and it's a huge distraction because it's not real. Kellner is such a backbencher in the Likud that he got in under the wire because of the Norwegian law. Like he's number 34. He's a nobody in the scheme of things for this gravely critical, momentous, fateful decision that we need to have. And he might as well have just said, we're going to make a committee that has a butcher, a baker, and a candlestick maker as any of the nonsense that he says here. And we can look at this, at take it at face value, and have a conversation about whether we think there should be a role for family members of hostages or fallen soldiers, and whether they're in any way equipped to be, you know, good members of such a committee. But I feel like it's just such a, it's as if these people read the Harry Frankfurt book, you know, on bullshit, as a how-to guide instead of a critique of how things are run, because it's bullshit. It is a time, it's yet another, we had this conversation in the last topic about, you know, treading water, wasting time. This is a time waster. This kind of a thing would spend months, if not years, going through, you know, committees and debates, and we have an avenue for having a commission, and this, you know, the effort has really been to undermine not just the court, you know, for the commission, but really it's all about continuing this path of the judicial overhaul by saying that the courts cannot be relied on, that the Supreme Court justice, you know, the newly sworn in one, to which this government did not show up to the ceremony, they're worthless and should not be, you know, taken seriously. And at the very best, as a time waster. But what I really think it is this continued ongoing effort to drive a wedge and undermine this pillar of Israeli democracy. You know, just yesterday, when I had this moment, I have to say, I listened to the whole ceremony of the changing of the changing of the chiefs of staff, as Herzi Levy left as promised, took responsibility, and resigned from his position, and Ayal Zamir was instated. And I noticed that Netanyahu, who has been deeply mean and unkind and accusatory of the military and specifically personally against Herzliya Levy, he spoke glowingly of him. And it was very unexpected. And I thought, wow, wow. And what was happening at exactly that moment was Yariv Levin was taking down the, you know, the attorney general, was setting in motion this path. So I cannot think of a more cynical move than sending this clown up to put up this kind of a ridiculous proposal.
I really disagree with you, and I wish that you would look at this a little differently. First of all, Ari Kellner is not a clown. He's just young. He's in his 30s, and he's extremely accomplished, and he's in his 30s, and he's already almost 20 years in politics, and he's someone that you're going to be seeing in the future. So
I don't think
that he's a clown. And the prime minister asked them to put together this plan, which would be the party's plan.
That is the guy that you ask when you want this incredibly...
No, it's clearly... It's true that one of the reasons why the prime minister probably chose him was because he could see him, as Sarah said in the introduction, as a sacrificial MK. It carries a different kind of weight than if he had his minister of justice to propose this. But I do think that it's worth taking the proposal seriously and trying to understand specifically, instead of just calling people clowns, try to understand specifically what is wrong with it from your perspective. Because I think it is an attempt that is partially successful to address a real problem that arises from, at minimum, the perception that the courts, as Prime Minister Netanyahu said yesterday or the day before yesterday in the hearing in the Knesset about these commissions of inquiry that went so disastrously for him, that the judicial commissions, you don't really need to convene them because you already know before they are convened what their conclusions will be. And I don't agree with the prime minister when he says that specifically, but there is a problem. And one of the reasons why I think that it ought to be possible for us to recognize that there's a problem is if you look at the commissions of inquiry, you know, the hit ones of which you spoke about, Sarah, they have not, by and large, been so successful. Some have and some have not. And the way in which those that have been less successful have been less successful really reflect exactly the criticism that the prime minister and that Ariel Kellner and that others in the Likud and in the right wing have of these commissions. If you look at the Agronaut Commission, it came back having evaluated what is in Israeli history the thing most similar to October 7th, the great surprise in the Yom Kippur War. And they came back with no criticism of politicians at all, which at the time was described, I've been reading the old newspapers, at the time was described by many people as, look, the justices, they have lunch with the politicians all the time. The justices come from the same place. They studied together. They were each other's professors at the Hebrew University. And so it's no surprise that they gave the politicians a complete pass because they and the politicians are, you know, are friends. And that was the criticism of the left wing of the Agronaut Commission back then. If you look at the commission that investigated the children who went missing from Yemen and the Balkans, there were actually three commissions, but it ended in one commission that went on for 4 years. And I have read thousands of pages of that for some research that I was once working on. And though they produced a record that is really, really important and valuable, in the end, they sound, to me, when I read it, they sound like old, out-of-touch Ashkenazim, for the most part, who have no clue, who still feel some of the same condescension that the people that they're ostensibly investigating from, you know, decades before felt as Ashkenazim, looking at these Yemenites saying, oh, they, you know, you can't really believe what they say. They think all sorts of things. They believe in, you know, they believe in Dybbuk's and stuff like that. These commissions are really largely often a reflection of the particular very narrow demographic of the that produces them, which are these. So that when someone in the Likud says, "Look, I just do not believe that we're going to get a fair shake," and half the country doesn't believe it, let's come up with an alternative. Then I think that it ought to be taken seriously. I don't want to just in a blanket way condemn the courts either. I do think that the perception that the courts are biased is largely a product, for cynical political reasons, of a campaign that Prime Minister Netanyahu and his people have orchestrated. But this has been successful, this campaign, in part because there is an element of truth to it. And so therefore, I think that in the end, you know, the to me and to my mind, the most successful commission ever of inquiry in the country was the one that investigated the Lebanon War, not Sabra and Shatila, but the Lebanon War in general. And that was not run by the judges. That was a government-appointed commission of inquiry. So to say that this is clownishness and that this it just doesn't seem like the best way that we can respond. Sarah, what do you think?
I think the question is can you leave the issue of emasculating the courts aside and look at what the substance of this proposal is? And I understand for some people it is impossible to divide the two, but coming from a very naive perspective, I looked at the constituency that they're seeking to appoint. And it did make sense to me that you have representatives from these various establishments. And I'm not sure that, you know, the system is rigged. I find it very hard to believe, and maybe again, I'm naive, that anybody is going to come back and say, no, there were no mistakes made by the military or by the security establishment or by any other party that may be found to be at fault here. Even if these representatives are chosen from within these groupings, the October 7th massacres and subsequent hostage taking and war, I think, were so profoundly evidentiary in and of themselves of the way things have gone so terribly wrong, that I guess I have to trust somewhat in the process that, you know, prima facie, there is obviously a problem here, and that no commission, no matter what the constituency of it is going to come to some kind of conclusion that, you know, everything was kumbaya and nothing went wrong on October 7th. But I agree that the politicization of this, especially in contradiction of the desires of the families, which I think has to be taken sincerely into account. They can't just be pushed aside as they constantly are, you know, even in the Knesset gallery itself, is meaningful. And maybe even more space should be made on this new commission for them in order to empower them and their voices in this discussion, because obviously their critique of where was the army, where were the politicians, where was the security establishment while I was hiding in a safe room is extremely relevant.
But why would they be members of the panel and not simply called in for testimony?
Because it seems to me that Kellner has allowed space for hostage families or the families of the fallen to be included. So why couldn't we expand their voice within the commission itself?
Because that's a different role. I mean, I understand that it's different in the sense that they are not under investigation. So it's not the same as putting, you know, politicians who might be a part of the problem on the commission. I'm simply saying I think it's just a populist move it wouldn't elicit the response it did in fact elicit from the main umbrella organization or official representative. I'm sure not all of the hostage families agree with everything that's said there, so it's hard to know. But, you know, he was trying to get them on board, and they saw it for what I think it is.
Look, to me, at the end of the day, 75% of the Israeli public has already said Benjamin Netanyahu needs to go. The IDF and the security establishment need to take responsibility for what happened on October 7th. And whether or not this commission finds it to be true as a result of their extensive egalitarian inquiry, I don't know what can be done, because, again, these rulings are non-binding, and we're subject to the will of politicians and others who simply won't take responsibility for October 7th. And I don't know that yet another commission, whether it's done by Supreme Court justices or some other, you know, constituency of inquiry is going to make any difference. At the end of the day, Bibi doesn't want to resign. The IDF or other bodies don't want to, you know, make the changes necessary to really reckon with what happened on October 7th. And the security establishment is in the same position. I don't know what can move the dial here. And I'm not sure that this commission is necessarily the problem, although I see the political problems of it.
I think that ultimately the most important outcome of a commission like this will have to do with structural change that may well be adopted. You're right that ultimately the whatever commission investigates will end up with a report that makes it clear that the prime minister was given signs that something was afoot and he ignored them to some degree. It's going to be damning, including, you know, if tomorrow the commission that was proposed by Ari Kellner was adopted, it would also come out with something like that. And the prime minister will not have to, nor will he probably resign as a result of this. And there will be elections at the latest in another 18 months. And then voters will decide, which is what you would want. You would not want a commission to decide to remove your prime minister. But what the commission can do is give very detailed analysis of exactly why what went wrong. And it may have to do with too much power being invested in the prime minister. It may have to do with too little power being invested in the prime minister. It may have to do with the lack of proper structural communications relations between the army and the intelligence people and the executive and the prime minister. I don't know what that would be like, but hopefully it's there that you would want the commission to produce something of value.
So I will say that one great thing about this time is that we get to hear the term ipcha mistabra over and over again, the meaning of it in Aramaic being the opposite is evident, and that is how those who have the role of arguing with accepted assumptions and going up against the decision makers at a high level and saying, no, this is the alternative reading of this reality. And it was a very important outcome of the investigation into the Yom Kippur War. And people are saying that it was reduced and sort of marginalized, and that there is there was no staff in various important decision making roles who were supposed to be the Ipcha Mistabra team, you know, arguing. And
who out there who might be interested in learning more about the kind of vaunted place in Israel's history of Ipcha Mistabra, I recommend that you see the documentary World War Z by Adam Brooks, where it really plays very, very significantly. Now listen to this.
עכשיו אתה בבית, עכשיו אתה שם. הילדים קופצים עליך, הכי יפים בעולם. אתה נמס, פורס ידיים, אתה מאושר ממש. ועוד מעט תקרא סיפור מהספר החדש. איש משפחה למופת אתה, אבא מושלם. בסוף אתה תמיד חוזר, לא עוזב לעולם. בכל פעם שנוסע לא שוכח מתנות לכולם. ועכשיו אתה בבית, עכשיו אתה שם. לבד על הגג, שבתות וחגים. לבד על הגג, שבתות וחגים. ותתפלאי לה
That song is Shabbatot V'Chagim by Iran Tzor with Corinne Alal off his kinda heartbreaking new record, Simanim Makdimim. You can find the album in all the usual places. And now it is time for our Vada Country segment. This is the part of the show in which each of us describes something that maybe brought us solace as we wended our way through our worlds over the last little while, or possibly surprised and amused, delighted and enchanted, ensorcelled, or maybe even flugged us as we did that same wending through that same world. Sarah, what is your Vada Country?
My Vada Country is, the perils of being new here and the overwhelming need to interact with Israeli bureaucracy on a now daily basis. If you've ever been on the hold with the Iria, the municipality of Jerusalem, they've now changed the hold music that is now trying to be much more egalitarian and democratic. It used to be over and over, Iriat Yerushalayim, Anachnu Kan Bishvilcha, Iriat Yerushalayim, the municipality of Jerusalem, we are here for you, but you as a masculine you. Recently, they have now changed the jingle to add an additional line, which doesn't rhyme with anything, that says, Iriat Yerushalayim, Anachnu Kan Bishvilech, Iriat Yerushalayim, Jerusalem municipality, we are here for you, feminine. So it's in the feminine version of the noun. Unfortunately, despite the fact that the jingle has now become much more inclusive, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion all the way to the bank, which the Iria is trying to take me for, I still haven't gotten any of my bureaucratic needs satisfied, but at very least I'm feeling, you know, much more included in the 25 minutes that I've spent on hold this week with them in their jingle, and hopefully someday in actuality.
That's fantastic. We see you.
We're here for you.
We're here for you.
Jerusalem has citizens, and it also has girl citizens, and that's really super. But before we go on, would you mind singing that jingle one more time? Because I'd like to have it as my ringtone.
Sure. Iriat Yerushalayim, anachnu kan bishvilcha, and then Iriat Yerushalayim, anachnu kan bishvilech.
Ladies and gentlemen,
anachnu kan bishvilech.
Uber scholar Sarah Hirshhorn. Miriam, what is your Vada Country?
Yesterday, a message on a WhatsApp friends group let me know that our pal Roxanne had quit her job and gone north to begin a long volunteer stint on Kibbutz Baram, which is right on the border with Lebanon. It turns out the kibbutz movement had asked for volunteers, retirees, to help out at kibbutz communities where residents have been evacuated, the ones near Gaza and the ones in the north. I had somehow missed the memo about Roxanne's plan, so I cajoled her into telling me more about it.
I'd seen a little thing on TV about this, and it piqued my attention a little bit, didn't think too much about it. And at some point, I did call the kibbutz movement and ask a little bit more about what was involved. And then the motivating force was I saw Gadi Moses when he got out, and I suddenly had this overwhelming feeling of pride in the kibbutz movement and who we are.
Gadi Moses. So if you followed the hostage releases, you'll remember how terrifying it was when Gadi Moses was freed. That's the one where the handover to the Red Cross was utter chaos. As masses of Hamas supporters screamed and pressed in, we feared that after surviving 482 days in captivity, the 80-year-old would be lynched right there. Moses, who was kidnapped from Nir Oz, embodies the kibbutz ethos. He's the proverbial salt of the earth, an agronomist, a farmer, a true kibbutznik. It's no surprise that he inspired Roxanne, herself a farmer, a conservationist with a varied career in agriculture and science, and deep in her bones, a kibbutznik. She's someone who has not just watched, but has lived the shifts in Israel's kibbutzim over the decades. Like the majority of kibbutz communities, her own home, Kibbutz Gezer, went through a privatization some years ago. But October 7th and its aftermath have cast a new light on the Israeli kibbutz.
Even though it's not what it was when I made Aliyah in the 80s, it still is a force, and it still is something to be proud of, and it still is, we are still out there on the borders. And it felt important for me to do something to help the kibbutznikim who have been not in their homes and were coming back. I suddenly felt a big drive to want to do something to help them.
When I asked Roxanne to tell me about all this, she pushed back at first. She said it was too soon, she'd only been there a couple of days, but things are happening fast. Just yesterday, dozens of elderly kibbutz members, people in their 80s and 90s, moved back into their homes after spending 17 months as evacuees in Tiberias hotels.
They're very excited, and it's very emotional in all sorts of ways. They're happy to be back. They're scared to be back. It's a flood of emotions for them, and it was amazing to be here and be a little part of that.
Roxanne is busy with a good kind of busyness. Someone had baked 40 cakes to welcome the old-timers back, and those cakes needed to be delivered to the houses. And there is a lot of gardening to do to bring the neglected grounds back to life. And there are groups of volunteers, mostly high school graduates from the area, to coordinate. For Roxanne, being on Baram helps answer a question. What are we supposed to be doing?
All of us are feeling a little bit like we don't know what to do to help the situation. It feels like something needs to be done. We go to demonstrations. We wear our little yellow bracelets for the hostages. This felt like something that could make a difference to people who've been having a harder time than me. And that would be also good for me.
A photo Roxanne shared on WhatsApp is of a bulletin board in Baram's communal dining room. Look at the bulletin board, she wrote. It is frozen in time. In the photo, next to notices about soccer practice and workout sessions, there's a poster announcing an upcoming event at another kibbutz, Kfar Blum, to celebrate all those born in 1943. Huh? Why 1943? It took me a moment. But the notice is from 2023, so those born in 43 turned 80 that year. A big number, worth celebrating. The Ethics of the Fathers calls 80 the age of strength. The poster says the event will take place on October 26, 2023. But of course, it never did. When they should have been whooping it up at Kfar Blum, those 80-year-olds, under threat of Hezbollah attack, were displaced in Tiberias. As of yesterday, the bulletin board with that poster was still waiting for an update. The thing that people like Roxanne know, that kibbutzniks like Roxanne know, is that it will take just one person to replace that notice with a new one, announcing a new upcoming celebration in a new and better future.
Hear, hear. That was beautiful.
What a story.
Yeah. So mine is really a direct continuation of your What a Country, Sarah, with its intimations of the feminist revolution that we're all seeing around us. On Sunday, I biked over to Alma. It's called the Center for Jewish Culture, but you would be forgiven if you called it a secular yeshiva, because most every time you step into the building, there are clashes of people studying Talmud or the rabbis or Hasidut or something like that. And the walls of the rooms are lined with books, 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 books. And every year on Shavuot, I try to end the night there, because at their tikkun at 3 a.m. or sometimes 4 a.m, they have some amazing singer perform on the roof. Last year, I saw Esther Rada. A few years ago, it was Kobi Oz. And there is a magic to the place. It's run by a woman named Ruth Calderon, who started it 20-odd years ago. Her boy and my boy were, for a time, best friends in grade school at the School for the Arts here in Tel Aviv. So we went in circles together, though every time we met, she inevitably had no memory of me at all. I think that I have met her afresh maybe 15 times. But me, I am obsessed with her because she has written some amazing books, one about women in the Talmud, and they're learned and they're feminist and they're brilliant, these books. And lately, she wrote a book about her parents after she had found a cache of letters that they wrote to each other before she was born. And I am, like I said, obsessed with her also because when she was a member of the Knesset in Yair Lapid's party maybe a dozen years ago, she proposed my favorite bill of all time, which was that during Shemitah, the sabbatical year when the crops lay fallow, and especially during the Yovel, the Jubilee year, every 50 years, every seventh Shemitah, That's when the Torah says all the slaves go free and all the debts are forgiven. On these milestone years, according to the bill that Ruth Calderon submitted to the Knesset, in these years, for people struggling to make ends meet, their debts would be forgiven in some fashion by the banks. And there was a complicated way of making sure that the banks wouldn't collapse as a result of this. It was a beautiful bill, and it was actually moving forward, though sadly her party left the coalition and the bill died a purgatorial death after that happened, but I never forgot it. Anyway, on this day, I was going to see Ruth Calderon and two other women, Sima Rokach Ochayun, who's a big muckamuck in Na'amat, the women's organization of the old socialist labor establishment, and also Avigal Sperber, who's an old friend of yours, Miriam. Though me, I am starstruck by her every time I see her because she is one of, in my view, the great documentary film directors that I've ever seen. She made a movie that I loved. I talked about it on the podcast a bit, about a guy named Shalom Nagar, who was this man of like great decency, who somehow, as a man who happened to work in a prison, got the task of first guarding and then hanging Adolf Eichmann, and after that, incinerating his body, which was a thing that we see in the movie, changed the course of his life. And she also made this beautiful movie about her adoptive sister and her remarkable family that I saw with you, Miriam, back in the day. And she has a new movie about the great tragic life of the great lesbian punk rock idol Inbal Perlmutter. And Avigal Sperber, she also founded Bat Kol, which is an organization of religious lesbians. And these three women were all recently elected to the Tel Aviv-Jaffa Rabbinical Council. Sima and Avigal were re-elected, and Ruth Calderon was elected for the first time. And I biked over to listen to the three of them trying to dope out what you can do with the Tel Aviv-Jaffa Rabbinical Council if you're a feminist who is maybe a little bit ambivalent about the rabbis, at least the rabbis who turn up in the Rabbinical Council. And the Rabbinical Council used to be maybe exactly what you imagine it would be, a bunch of mostly black-frocked, could have been extras on shtissel sort of rabbis, all men, of course. And in a lot of places, it is still that. But then way back in 1988, a then 37-year-old woman named Leah Shaktiel, who I think, Miriam, you also know, she got herself appointed to the Rabbinical Council in Yerucham, the first woman ever to be appointed to any Rabbinical Council. And she had to appeal it all the way to the Supreme Court to get the council to actually invite her to the meetings. And this was, at the time, a measure of how things were beginning to change around us. And now in Tel Aviv, I think 5 of the 12 members of the Rabbinical Council are women. And what women? They know Talmud and they know philosophy and they are brilliant and they make art. And there in Amma, they start to talk. And Sima tells how she got it in her head that it makes no sense that there are no mashgichot, women kashrut supervisors, because she says, in kosher homes, kashrut is a thing that women know a thing or two about. And she said, she went to the Rabbinical Council and she said, we need women kashrut mashgichot. And the rabbi said, but that's never been done before. And Sima said, but it could be. And the rabbi said, well, I guess it could be. And then it was. And Sima organized the first ever course for women overseeing kosher certification. And she says, look, this is just no big thing. This is a small thing, but still it's a thing. And at the time you could feel it's a thing. And then Avigal Sperber, she says, one thing that I think we could do is make it easier for queer couples to get their kids who are born to surrogates all Jewed up. You know, they need to be converted because they're born to women typically, you know, abroad who typically aren't Jewish. And then there was talk about alternative mikvahs, where like the people running them are like have a whole different attitude about everything. And then there was talk about single-sex marriage and having halachic single-sex marriages, which Avigal Sperber's father, who was a great Talmud scholar and professor at Bar-Ilan and rabbi, he was the first Orthodox rabbi to ordain Orthodox women to the rabbinate in Israel. So he has a thing or two to say about this. And I was thinking about growing up in yeshiva where things were this way and not that way. That was my youth. Things are this way and they're not that way. And the way things were, it was the way things would always be. And now I'm seeing in front of my very eyes a whole other theory of the case, a whole other theory of religion, of Judaism. And the thing about it was in its way so reverent. It was like an act of love. It wasn't like trashing Judaism, it was the opposite. It was saying, we believe in this stuff and we see value in this stuff. And we see why those people in the robes and the kaftans and the funny hats, why they love the stuff that they love. And we just want to do our part to make it something that we can love too. And that brings us to the end of our show. Thanks to Itai Shelem, our station manager, without whom there would be none of this. Thanks to Ashibo Lim, my favorite band from Kibbutz Geva. They give us some music at the start and the end of our show. Thank you, Miriam. Thank you, Natalie. Thank you, Sarah. And we'd like to thank all of our Patreon supporters whom we stiffed this week, extra special, special extra segment-wise. We'd like to still thank you for your generosity and support. It keeps the show going and the station going, and it keeps us moved and grateful and in your debt. All the more so on a week like this when we repay your generosity with nothing save for boatloads of grateful karma streaming your way. We'd like to thank all of you out there as well for taking the time to listen and actually like us on Facebook and drop us a line. We are going eventually to answer. After you do that, go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. Maybe one that starts with this, the Promise Podcast, colon, keeping its head above water barely for 14 and a half years, .. Finish that any way you want. But before you do that, remember that today, as we record, on March 6th, we celebrate International Oreo Day, so stipulated to commemorate the beloved baked treat, the trademark of which was registered, interestingly, not on March 6th, but on March 14th, 1912, just under 113 years ago, comprising the inventions covered by several patents, including patent U.S. 4455333A, quote, a patent for doughs and cookies that maintain texture stability during storage, and patent U.S. 8114451B2, a patent for a resealable closure that includes a tamper-evident feature, and patent U.S. 4948602A for being filled cookies that are hard enough to resist denigration by a filling needle. One webpage devoted to International Oreo Day includes a helpful Oreo cookie timeline showing the highlights of the development of the cookie from a generally expansive perspective. I appreciated this as a historian, beginning with, quote, 7th century AD, cookies are invented, colon. Cookies may have originated during this time in Persia when sugar became more commonplace. And then the timeline jumps straight from there 1,300 years to, quote, 1898, Nabisco Company is formed, East Hanover, New Jersey, sees the National Biscuit Company formed, which is the parent company of the Oreo cookie, end quote. And if you ever wonder why the years between the 7th century and 1898 are often thought of as the Dark Ages, I think you have your answer right there. From there, it is on to 1912 when Oreo cookies are introduced. 2004, quote, Milk's Favorite Cookie campaign starts. That's an ad campaign. And that is pretty much the timeline. Of course, if it were up to me, I would add 1998, the introduction of kosher Oreos. What we are told amounted to the most expensive adoption of kosher certification in corporate history, as the old lard-inflected machines all had to go, which may be considered to be a high point in Jewish history as well, not just the history of the Oreo cookie, allowing us to say Bidrox to Hydrox. And I might add to the Oreo timeline, the recent proliferation of quote-unquote stuff, the typically white cream sandwiched between the two typically dark brown cookies, which proliferation included the double stuff, which was then followed by the triple stuff, and then the triple double stuff, and then the big stuff, and then the mega stuff, and finally, the most stuff Oreo cookie, or the summum bonum of sandwich cookies, the end of history for the sandwich cookie, as how can you have more stuff than is contained in a cookie named the most stuff? It's like God creating a boulder so big that God's self cannot lift it. It is preposterous, but I digress. And obviously, I love International Oreo Day. It has got to be my favorite day the entire year because the cookie is amazing, sure, but also because the cookie is not just a cookie. It is a lesson on how to live life, as we learned long ago from Homer Simpson.
I can't live the button-down life like you. I want it all. The terrifying lows, the dizzying highs, the creamy middles. Sure, I might offend a few of the blue noses with my cocky stride and musky odors. Oh, I'll never be the darling of the so-called city fathers who cluck their tongues, stroke their beards, and talk about what's to be done with this homie Simpson.
There is wisdom in the cookie. Still, even though where I am recording from in Maryland, International Oreo Cookie Day started only 5-something hours ago, still I know that soon International Oreo Day will be gone, like the Marshmallow Moon limited edition Oreo that came out in June 2019 to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the first human ever to walk on the moon. They had moon gray cream in the middle. Moon gray cream, not white, gray. But then they were gone, leading me each week to ask my grocer, are they back? Are the moon Oreos here again? And he always says, no, son, they are not. They may never be back. Not so the Promise Podcast. We will be back for you next week and every week, reminding you that while it's probably important to face the fact that the Marshmallow Moon Oreos may never come back, especially now that the news is that asteroid 2024 YR4 is probably going to smash the moon to bits, it is equally important to remember that there are some things that always were and always will remain gray inside on this, the Promise Podcast.